Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we continue playoff coverage. We take a look at these 2-2 series as they turn into best of threes. What's going to happen in Hawks-Knicks? What needs to happen in Cavs-Raptors? And then we play a nice game of are they cooked with the teams that are down in their respective series. We got some 3-1s. We got a 3-2 as Denver was able to notch things up. But we talk about that. And then we shift to the W side. We got preseason action to react to. We have more preseason matchups coming up. Steve and I talked through what we like and what we are expecting to see for the other teams making their preseason debuts. Stick with us. We're going to have a good time. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I'm Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are we doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. It's playoff time. We got more basketball to talk about, and I'm ready to break it down with you. Let's go.
Let's have some fun. Let's have some fun. We have a pair of 2-2 series, Steve. We have a 3-2 series, a lot of 3-1s. We had one end last night. A lot of ground to cover. We're going to start with the tied series. We're going to start with a game happening later tonight. The Atlanta Hawks, the New York Knicks, tied at 2 games apiece. The Knicks with a pivotal game four victory over the Atlanta Hawks over the weekend, 114-98. Karl Anthony Towns with a 20-point triple-double, the fourth playoff triple-double in Knicks history. So salute to Karl Anthony Towns for that game. So Steve, just kind of broadly speaking, was this an example of the Knicks executing, or did you feel like they did anything differently to kind of flip the tide against the Atlanta Hawks in this one?
Well, I mean, when you dive into a series, you see different moments from different teams, different times. I think what the Knicks lacked in intention in that game three, they found in that game four. They had a lot of purpose offensively. They were looking to execute. They were looking to attack, and they were able to put off-ball movement back on the table, which I thought was huge, which gave you the double sword of, hey, we're playing through Karl Anthony Towns and he's involved. We're using Jalen Brunson as a pressure point, but we're also not giving you exactly just straight pick and roll, just trying to hammer you in one different way. So you're able to kind of get some of these back picks for OG Adonobi. You're able to kind of get some of this movement to where we're not just relying on a pick and roll to create an advantage. We can still layer that in, but we have this mindset to kind of keep pressure on you a different way. We're going to poke at Jonathan Kuminga. We're going to poke it if you want to switch off ball. We're going to just navigate things a little bit differently. So I think the Knicks had the idea of we want to do this offensively, then defensively, you're not going to have as good of a time. And so Josh Hart being able to mix in moments on CJ and just kind of keep pressure on Atlanta that way. They played the game on their terms to a degree. I think one of the things we can forget about in a playoff series is the fact that both teams kind of fight. Both teams put pressure on each other. There's a story to the series to a degree. Then there's just moments where who gets it done? I think as we go into this now best out of three series between these two teams, we know exactly what each team can do to each other. It's all about who's going to get it done. And if I'm New York, you got to be intentional on offense. You got to keep Karl Anthony Towns involved, and you got to be able to defend at a certain level. If you're Atlanta, we have to take some of this off the board to where Cat can't be as effective. Jalen Brunson has a bad time, and then we can push and transition, but we have to execute at the right times in the half court. So I don't know how much is left game plan wise to dig into, but it's a lot of who's going to find the right answers at the right moment to me.
No, I think that's fair. And I'm glad that you hit on the intention of the New York Knicks, because I think that's kind of where I started offensively. Like, first possession of the game, let's get a screen from Josh Hart to get CJ McCollum. Now let's flow to two-man action with Karl Anthony Towns, your Jalen Brunson. Let's see how y'all want to deal with that. And the way that they went after CJ to begin this game, on ball and off ball, to your point, Steve, it spoke to, we have to make this a pressure point. One, it just unlocks things for us offensively. Let's see if we can get Brunson going a little bit easier. Let's see if we can get Karl Anthony Towns involved earlier in the game. There's also just the cumulative effect of, if we're putting you in action a bunch, maybe you don't have the legs to hit the amount of pull-up jumpers that you've hit over the last couple of games. Like, let's also just ding you a bit. Even if we don't score, there's something positive happening here, because we're just making you do more and making you do more consistently than you have in previous games. So, like, I like that for the New York Knicks. I was waiting on, like, the obligatory flex tweet from you as you were threading the game, as the Knicks just kept hammering Jalen Brunson screen in the corner. Let's see if we can get OG and Obi downhill. It's like, yeah, it's never going to die, as a wise man once said. So, like, that part was fun for me. I think quickly to the game plan portion of this, it was interesting. it was interesting to me to see Josh Hart moved around the board defensively. It also kind of sparked a thought for me with the Atlanta. There was a question that I had heading in was when slash how often were they going to press the cross matching button? And like, we've only seen it in spurts when they go smaller and you have Jonathan Kuminga on Karl-Anthony Towns, which is why I'm glad that you hit on the fact that the Knicks also tried to poke at that matchup a little bit in the game four. But that kind of feels like the last big button to press for the Atlanta Hawks if they feel like, okay, let's actually fully commit to Jalen Johnson on Karl-Anthony Towns or wing on Cat on Onyeka Okongwu-Roe. Let's see if we can play out of that. I've been waiting on them to do that with more volume. They haven't. And the fact that this is a tied series without having to press that button, I think bodes well for them. But that's kind of question number one for me. As we enter this best three, as you mentioned, like, are we going to see the Hawks do that? Because they do, to your point, need to be able to get stops to juice that transition attack. Because in the half court, it's been up and down. And I think some of the CJ shot making has covered over how spotty the half court execution can be at times for this Hawks group.
I mean, I think it's just part of it is more so for Atlanta. I don't know if it's particularly just the specific matchup. You just need the Knicks to move to something else and not have the certain level of confidence offensively that they've displayed in this series at different times. You need them to be more game three Knicks where we're searching for something or trying to hammer a certain thing home as opposed to we know we can do A, B, and C. We're going to kind of cycle through things. And it was interesting because one part of the playoffs is like a team's game plan is designed to take something away from you, but also just to kind of keep you in search mode or trying to figure out how can we execute, can we solve this problem type beat. You always kind of end up in a series hitting a defense just enough to where they like allow you to get back to what you wanted to attack all along. So if you remember early in that fourth quarter, especially when Bradley was out there, Knicks can go Brunson, Cat, pick and roll. Bradley has to show a little bit. That opens the pop. That opens the rotation. OG gets a three. Like that's where the back and forth doesn't really, it hurts you in a tough scenario. And so if I'm the Knicks, if I have off-ball movement, that, again, the Hawks took that away in games two and three. Like it was really good in game one. It was really good in game four. The Hawks said we're going to be active and physical, and so the Knicks pivoted away from it. If they can have the blend offensively with their top-tier talent that you can manipulate matchups with, that's when the Knicks, I think, are the hardest in this particular matchup. If I'm Atlanta, I've got to get them back into trying to figure different things out, trying to maneuver different ways. Because if you're giving switches off-ball actions, you're getting pin downs, now you get a one-on-one for Jalen Brunson that gets big, or now we are able to get a switch and now bring a pick and roll to the action with two defenders you don't necessarily want to have navigate, those are the subtle ways we can poke at you and still get to what we want to do. If I'm Atlanta, I got to take that away. And I have to be sharper in the half court. You know, I think there's always an element of transition with Atlanta. They have to be sharper in the half court in this series to kind of just elevate and win.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm right there with you. I think, quickly to your point on the Knicks offense, then flipping that to Atlanta before we move, I think that's where the fact that we saw Tony Bradley is kind of a testament to what the New York Knicks were able to do in terms of their overall intention and their effectiveness offensively in that game. Like Karl-Anthony Towns, 9 drives doesn't sound like a lot. The tie for this highest in the series so far. 2 points per possession on Karl-Anthony Towns drives in game four. Like literally statistically a guaranteed basket on possessions where Karl-Anthony Towns drove the basketball. And so when the Hawks flow into these lineups where you have Jonathan Kuminga, Moge, you're just going smaller than the non-Onyeka minutes or even when Onyeka's out there. If Karl-Anthony Towns just puts his head down and said, actually, I am just taking you with me. And he had some ridiculous finishes in this basketball game. Hey, man, we kind of need a little bit more size if Cat is imposing his will this way. And like even earlier in the series where he wasn't getting those touches, what he was able to do on the offensive glass earlier in the series, like there has been, you know, so there's been kind of a fluctuation in terms of how often he's being used, where he's been used, et cetera. But there's always kind of been this underlying thread of like Cat can kind of flip this in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. Maybe offensive rebounding. To your point, when we do get fives on him, we can open up the pick and rolls or the pick and pops, or we can just have him stationed above the break, flow into some of the cuts and splits from there. Like, we don't really have a great answer to this dude. Our best shot is Onyeka Okongwu, who is still technically smaller than Cat. If you're able to ding Onyeka, then you get smaller. If Cat's aggressive, he's getting downhill. Oh, snap, what do we do? If you're sending extra attention to this, this unlocks the shooting that we saw from the New York Knicks. This unlocks the cutting that we saw from the New York Knicks. And it just gets a lot more fun from there. So I'm right there with you. Like, they are going to have to take something off the board. But they got to make sure Cat gets back bottled up if we're talking about the stars here. Because even in this game four, like, it wasn't an A-plus Brunson game. Timely, but Cat flipped this one.
The last thing I was going to say is just keep an eye on the coverages for CJ McCollum. Josh Hart being on CJ McCollum is one thing. Cat being at the level and trapping is another. And yeah, if the Knicks get into an elimination type scenario, that could be something they just throw the kitchen sink at. So just keep an eye on that. We can move.
All right. Fair enough. Let's move to the other 2-2 series. And Steve, as we previewed Cavs Raptors, I said, you know, I'm very fascinated by this one because all three of the regular season matchups between those two teams happened before Thanksgiving. We don't have a ton to draw from. Fascinating styles clash between these two teams. It was looking hazy for the Toronto Raptors through the first two games. Like, hey, are they going to be able to score enough? What are these transition attacks looking like, et cetera? These last two games for the Raptors, as they've now tied the series, and Sunday was an unbelievably fun basketball game, aside from nobody being able to hit threes until the fourth quarter, apparently. It has been super impressive watching this Raptors group adjust. And ultimately, they've been able to impose their will on this series over the last two games. This is why I try to remind myself, like, hey, even when the team wins their first two games, they may just be taking care of home court. Like, let's see what these other two games are going to look like. The way that the Raptors have been able to shapeshift with their lineups, with their matchups, and ultimately own the paint the way that they have these last two games has been very impressive to me. I am fascinated with this. What? Go
ahead. We talked about it on Friday.
We did.
The Toronto Raptors, Darko, all the credit in the world for game two and him throwing everything at the Cleveland Cavaliers and putting the kitchen sink on the table and trying to say, hey, we can figure it out. The adjustment, again, once again, to put Jakob Poeltl on Evan Mobley was big in the sense that, okay, we're taking Jared Allen off the board. He's no longer a pick and roll threat. But now you have to think about the layers they added defensively to where, okay, that rhythm you displayed, James Harden, Donovan Mitchell, not only are we going to take away a pick and roll partner for you, we're going to randomly double team you at times so you can't catch a rhythm. So part of the secret sauce for game one and game two was Cleveland had Jared Allen rolling. They also had James Harden and Donovan Mitchell comfortable seeking different matchups. So Brandon Ingram, come here. RJ Barrett, come here. We're going to attack you one-on-one. We're going to score. Well, doesn't matter. If we're doubling you, you have to move the ball. And that changes kind of the outcome. And so we have the moments where Jakob Poeltl can kind of be on Evan Mobley, a different type of role. He can help. Colin Murray-Boyles comes in, gives a whole different kind of energy. And our guards, especially Scottie Barnes types, they can navigate these screens. We can trust that a little bit more, and we can just kind of take, one, your automatic flow away, and two, make sure you feel us in a different way. So every time you think, okay, we can just go with this, we take a piece of that away. So I thought the doubles were really important in games three and game four, especially game four, where it's just like, actually, I think it was like early second quarter, it's like, we're just going to double both of you. Doesn't matter. Don't care. Whatever. Move the ball. And so now you get Cleveland into a searching mode to a degree. And that's what you want to do if you're the quote-unquote lower seed or having to defend, or you have to put them in a box and take what they do really well and dissect it to where they're trying to find what anything that works so they can get back to themselves. I thought one of the most telling moments of that Toronto-Cleveland game, and obviously, you know, low-scoring game, but if you go back to that third quarter, right, I think they started the game or started the second half with a play for Evan Mobley. He drives and attacks Jakob Poeltl, and he scores. And the Raptors very quietly put Jakob Poeltl back on Jared Allen. And the Cavs saw that and went back to kind of that get action where we have two screeners, we throw it ahead, and then James Harden cuts off. But they did not attack Poeltl in the same voracious way. And the other part was Scottie Barnes was able to fight under. They were showing help. It was tough to go. The other part of what Toronto has done is Cleveland's committed to making sure Brandon Ingram hasn't had a good time. We're going to show help. Doesn't matter who guards you. We're going to help on your spin. We're going to double. Like, we're trying to make sure you don't have a good time. He had a huge run in that second quarter. But Scottie Barnes playing with a high level of force, taking it back to the 80s, to the 90s, to the old school, and saying, I'm going to back you down. And now, you remember early in the series where they were able to kind of show help. Evan Mobley was able to scram switch. We could control our rotations to a degree. You go to game three, game four, those rotations were not controllable. As soon as he looked like he was about to put his side and hit somebody, here's three defenders. Well, that's a little bit more reactionary help than he had been getting. But him being able to get into the paint, get a paint touch, get his shots going, that's great. So I think if Toronto, you have defense, you have Scottie Barnes, you have a looming Brandon Ingram game, you put Cleveland in a box, that's huge. If Cleveland, you got to understand what your lineups are. You got to understand how to get Donovan Mitchell and James Harden going again, and you got to get Jared Allen unlocked again. If the Cleveland Cavaliers over-tinker in this series, they could lose, because this is what a defensive team wants to do to you. Cleveland has to make sure this does not become like an old-school Grizzlies-Clippers type series where we just got you out of character and we beat you up. Now what?
Ooh-wee. And that's where, like, I'm glad you brought up them opening the third quarter with Evan Mobley, or play for Evan Mobley. Open the fourth quarter, I think, as well, with an Evan Mobley possession where he gets to get downhill and drive. It's just like, I like that they are sprinkling this stuff in for him. But to your point, they haven't been able to hit those notes consistently to where it is, okay, we're going to Evan Mobley three or four times in a row until you do something else. Or him just kind of imposing his will in that way. And I think to your point about Scottie Barnes and the help that he's seeing, like the aggression from Scottie perked up in the third or fourth quarter of game one was through. And since that moment, really, game two onward, he has just been putting his head down. I'm pushing in transition. Now, transition game was very ugly for Toronto in game two, but at least conceptually, like after misses, after makes, we want to make sure y'all don't wall off the paint like you did in game one. And like the fact that the Cavs have not been able to put that back in the two through three games now is a bit concerning if you're brought into the scope of what this next best three is going to be. And him being able to sprinkle in the short range shot making, the timely threes that we've seen from Scottie Barnes, if you want to span from game two onward, have been fun for me. But yeah, I'm with you though. This is Raptors defense for me. The Cavs obviously have to find some answers. Like, how can we get Jared Allen more involved? Are we trying to run some off-ball stuff? Are we going cross-screen to see if we can get someone smaller switched on to him? Let's see if we can poke at some stuff there. Is it off-ball screen to get a big back on Jared Allen before flowing into pick and roll? Like, is that what it's going to take? I'm not sure. But I think the Raptors deserve a lot of credit for the way they have matched up and the way they have put Cleveland in a box to this degree. Scottie Barnes on James Harden or Donovan Mitchell. You have RJ Barrett on Jared Allen, and then you just have a bunch of fun. And I think, I guess circling back to the help point, with Cleveland scrambling the way they have been as of late on some of these paint touches for Toronto, it's opening up the offensive glass in a way that has been kind of like a quiet thought in the back of my head with the Cavs. Like, how good of a rebounding team is this? Kyle Murray boils very loudly in game four, says, hey, I am cleaning up all of this. I wish I could remember who had the tweet, but the Cavs not logging a defensive rebound for like the last 4.5-5 minutes of game four seems impossible. But like, that was kind of the bit. I've been very impressed with just the overall readiness of Colin Murray boys on both ends of the floor. Like, him being part of the lineup in the fourth quarter where he's just guarding James Harden to open a possession was interesting to me. But yeah, this has been a very fun back and forth for me, Steve. I am excited to see what these next couple games look like. I guess the question I would pose to you, you obviously want to get Mitchell and or Harden. You obviously want to get both of them going if you can. Who do you think it's most important to get going heading into game five between Harden and Mitchell?
Harden. I think Harden. Even though Mitchell and Harden have not had their best two games in Toronto. But I think Donovan Mitchell was able to get going and almost give Cleveland the victory in that game four. I think you have to find the comfort for James Harden to become a pressure point a different way to where, okay, you're not really having fun with what we're doing. And so get him back going in pick and roll, get the drives back established. Mitchell, I think, can sustain and has had to for most of the season. But I think when you have James Harden, automatic pick and roll player, automatic drive and kick, drive and finish, get a bucket, that elevates the Cleveland offense. So we've seen the tale of two, I don't want to say series, but two moments. Like, game one and game two was, hey, this is why you bring Donovan Mitchell and James Harden together. And if you were on the other side, game three and four is like, well, this is what happens when you have Donovan Mitchell and James Harden together. So I think it's important for James Harden to reestablish himself as a force. I think Donovan's just going to be Donovan. But I think it's time for Big Jim to let the Raptors know what the Oos is cooking.
That is incredible. One stat that I will drop before you transition. Just looking at the half-court offensive rating for the Cleveland Cavaliers through the series so far. Game one, a 118.5 in the half-court. That is absurd. Game two, a 116.5 in the half-court. That is absurd. Game three, down to 93.4. That is not where you want to be. Would be towards the bottom of the league. Game four, an 80 offensive rating in the half court. Now, again, game four, nobody could shoot for 3.5 quarters. So, like, that's part of it. But, again, the Raptors deserve a lot of credit for making Cleveland uncomfortable with the way that they defended, with the pressure that they brought, with the way they're able to change schemes, with the matchup tweaking, et cetera. Very good stretch of games for Scotty Barnes. RJ Barrett continuing to drive and do a little bit of everything. Second unit popping for Toronto over these past two games as well. But yeah, just wanted to give the salute there. I'm excited to see how that one ends. Next series we want to talk about, Steve, going back to the result from last night, the Orlando Magic. Another win, a 3-1 series lead right now. Game three, a 113-105 victory. Paolo with a near triple-double. Game four, the game that happened last night, 94-88 victory, a grimy one. 18-8-4 for Paolo. Didn't shoot well, but still able to dictate terms. Time shot making for Desmond Bane, with Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. in attendance. So that was cool to see the sideline shot there. Oh, boy. I am impressed with what Orlando's been able to do. I was concerned following their game two loss. I was like, hey, I don't like that Detroit ramped up their switching to this degree and the offense looked like this. Now, I don't expect a 30-3 run in a quarter like we saw, but I didn't like what that offense was looking like. It still hasn't been great offensively, or at least not consistently for Orlando, but the defense has certainly perked up. They have doubled down on our switching, our help, our overall aggression. And aside from Cade, who's been dealing with his own turnover stuff, Detroit hasn't found consistent answers or consistent relief points. And that's kind of popping for me right now over these past couple of games. But what do you make of where this series is right now?
This is real playoff basketball. This is real hoops. This is a steel cage match. The story has been established, right? And if you go back, like, or if Orlando is able to defend at a certain level, keep the Detroit Pistons in a box offensively, and have this be a close game, they can just rely on the irrational confidence of Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, Desmond Bane, Jalen Suggs. Hopefully Franz gets well soon, but they have guys who will just take shots. And so we're not really talking about a ton of scheme stuff when it comes to the type of shots they're going to take and are willing to take and are looking to make. The Paolo, I'm going to shoot a pull-up from the top. Ooh, it went really high. Oh, it went in. The Desmond Bane, ooh, I felt the bank is still open somehow late at night. The margins for error are slim in this series. And I think it's Orlando successfully getting Detroit into a box and saying, we're going to defend at a high level. We're going to force turnovers. And I think that's the biggest thing for Detroit. For Detroit, like, everyone wants to talk about three-point shooting and secondary creation and all that good stuff. Defend and take care of the ball, and you give yourself a much better chance in that game. Here's the thing. The fact that they had, I believe, what was it, 7 turnovers in the first 4 minutes, they ended up with more turnovers and made field goals at some point in the first quarter, and they ended up coming back to lead that first quarter. This is a nonsensical series to a degree. But for Detroit, if you are turning the ball over and your defense is not A1, and I do not think it was in that game four. I think it was really good in game two, game three, back and forth, up and down. Game four, it was not great for most of it. They had to find it. Again, this is why I asked the question in the lead up to the playoffs, what happens when Detroit's defense gets dinged? Because if they get dinged, their margin for error now disappears. And now anyone who was like, well, I told you the offense wouldn't work, they can just raise their hand and yell and scream. The Magic have worked. The Magic have worked to take Jalen Duren off the table. And Detroit has not really been able to get him back rolling the way they did in game two, the second half. And because of that, now he is still searching late in this series. So if you have our anchor, one of our anchors in the half court is not there. Our defense sometimes is not there. We're turning the ball over. And we also have certain issues offensively. You've now put yourself in a tough position, in a tough bind. And I think you give credit to Orlando because they're game to have this specific fight. Like, if you look at the shot, if you look at this shot distribution, I know Jamal Cain came off and had a really great moment for Orlando, but it is those guys taking shots. And Paolo, who I think has been pretty lights out for most of the series, 4-for-18 in that game four. But he wasn't going to stop shooting. Desmond Bane, 7-of-18. He wasn't going to stop shooting. Jalen Suggs was 1-of-13 in game four, 1-of-11 for 3. He was not going to stop shooting. And so if you're Detroit, you have to have a level of separation. You've got to execute in those moments. You've got to keep Orlando pushed away. And that's going to require defense. It's going to require a whole lot of Cade Cunningham. I think that's the other thing. Orlando being able to wear on Cade to where not only, like, the positive for Detroit was we get Duren back rolling, Cade's attacking matchups. We at least have something we can sustain on. Cade didn't have a lot of fun in pick and roll. They did a good job of trying to mix him off ball. Get him some wide pin downs, get him some staggers, let him kind of get the movement into a screen. But it wasn't the same force he had in those game ones and games two as he developed, hey, I would like to attack all of you. You didn't feel that in Orlando. So now Detroit, backs are against the wall. Everything you've built has helped you sustain some of these tough moments, but it's all on display.
Yeah, it's, I guess, quickly to stick on the Cade Cunningham point, 22 drives in this game four for him. 0.67 points per possession on those trips featuring a drive. And like a lot of that is the turnovers that we saw. Gosh darn it, I guess I'll walk right into that one. A help defense rate of 100% in this basketball game on the Cade Cunningham drives. It's not new that he sees bodies, as he was towards the top of the list in terms of how much help he saw on drives overall during the regular season. And it's been relatively high throughout this series. It felt like Orlando doubled down on this. Like, we are still mixing in the switches. I think it just in general, they mixed in coverages, which to your point, that's why you mix in the off-ball stuff, see if we can get a different look. But anytime he got inside the arc, like, he's dealing with size because of the switches that Orlando was giving and who they had on the floor. And then it felt like anytime he got near or crossed the free throw line on a drive, we got somebody swiping in for like the nail or elbow area. And then we also have somebody at the rim ready to contest something. And like having that level of commitment, it wears on you. It really wears on you. And you look at some of the lineups that Detroit has out there. And again, this isn't a new point. We talked about this during the regular season and things while Detroit was winning 60 plus games. It's like their defense leads the dance because they have lineups where they have two or three, sometimes four really good defenders out there. But on the other end, teams are comfortable helping off of those guys. To your point, if the defense is at B plus level instead of A plus level, and in certain stretches is lower than that, J.B. Bickerstaff's going to be more inclined to say, let's get some of these defenders out here. Let's try to change the tide. Let's see if we can turn Orlando over, like we saw in the second, you know, the later portion of the first quarter, things as they're making their run. Let's see if we get some stops. That does make life a little tougher for Cade in the half court, though. And if Orlando is doubling down to this degree and they have this level of collective size, and you are seeing, you know, Franz on Cade, you're switching Wendell Carter Jr. on him, Paolo's taking the assignment sometimes. Here comes Jamal Cain. He's going to be tall and lanky and annoying against them. Length plus help, Cade is good enough, but that is a really tough job. And so I don't want to completely excuse the turnovers because you just do not want it to be as high as it is. But it's easy to see how they happen when he has that level of burden. And Orlando is defending like this and having this level of intention and help behind it, it makes life tough. And so this has very much become a possession game. And if Orlando is now dinging you on the offensive glass like you generally do to other teams, you're losing that battle. You're losing the turnover battle. You then factor in the three-point shooting on top of that. And then if Cade isn't insane as a shot maker, you're in a really tough spot. And that's where you go to the other end and you get the timely drives from Paolo at the end of that game. You get the timely shot making the bank shot from Desmond Bane. You get the poster from Jamal K. Heat legend Jamal Cain with the poster and just multiple big plays on both ends of the floor. This is how you end up 3-1. And so like, I don't think it is impossible for Detroit to turn this around. Like, shooting variance is going to help. They have been able to push and transition pretty much this entire series. And so like, if they're able to get stops and lean more on the defense, like it would be pretty... It would not surprise me at all. They flipped this. But Orlando deserves a lot of credit for putting Detroit in the box to this degree.
Well, very quickly, before we end, Danger Zone, with this Magic team playing with high confidence, believing they can attack almost anyone on the Detroit Pistons, that's something you want to monitor. So even if it doesn't happen in Game 5, they get to go back home and decide, actually, we're going to take this home in our arena because it's really hard to win in Orlando in the playoffs. Number two, very intrigued to see how people are going to discuss slash praise the Orlando Magic, considering how they talked about them during the play-in and when they lost to the Boston Celtics. Like, I'm very much keeping an eye on how that's going to be kind of explained. Are you just going to just roll the dice and try and double down and say, well, the Pistons shouldn't have lost? Yeah, I'm keeping an eye on it. I just want you to know, like, I'm trying to be kind. I'm trying to live a light life, but I will point it out when I see it, just so you know.
You saw them. There's film of what they did or did not do. Okay. Fair
That's
enough.
That's your line.
It is. And I'm going to make another one, Steve. It's time to take a break. When we return, we flip to some of these other 3-1 series and we ask a very simple question. Are these teams cooked? How many of these series will extend? How many of them are very close to the end? We talk about it. Stick with us. Thank you. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, we have more first round takeaways. We have some series nearing their ends. We're going to play a little game called Are They Cooked? So,
Oh, yeah, man. This is what I've been waiting for. Fell out with them folks. We ain't never making up. Back for everything I ever lost. I'm on a mission. We turned the whole house into a booth in the kitchen. Are they cooked?
So the Minnesota Timberwolves lead the series 3-2. Shout out, Glow. I have to talk about basketball now. That's neat. So game four, Minnesota, a 112-96 victory, in which on the low end, they lost Anthony Edwards. They lost Dante DiVincenzo in that game. Likely done for, well, Dante's certainly done for the season and done for the series at the very least, I would imagine, week to week with a knee injury. But on the high end, 43 points off the bench for Ayo Dosunmu, another 17-9 for Naz Reid, and they just completely took the game over in the second half. We then get to the game five, Steve. The Denver Nuggets jump on the Minnesota Timberwolves. It ends up being a 125-113 victory, a 27-12-16 game for Nikola Jokic. Just the shot making was back. Defense felt better. Early shot making for Jamal Murray. Spencer Jones, with Aaron Gordon missing this game as well, so we'll see what his status is going to be moving forward in the series. Spencer Jones, I'll defend Julius Randle. I'll switch out onto guards if necessary. I'll knock down threes. They look like they hurt, but that's okay. And now we're here. And so 3-2 series lead still for Minnesota. Nuggets down. Are they cooked, Steve? Or do you think they can come back from this deficit and ultimately win this series?
I think each of these teams, with it being 3-2, if you smell in the kitchen, what's that smell? Is that a Timberwolf or is that Nuggets? What you cooking? Because this is a very perilous moment for both of these teams. And I'll explain. So stick with me, right? For Minnesota, the work they did in games 3 and game 4 was outstanding, right? Game 1, Denver's defense was fantastic. You had Jokic, Murray, we're hitting the home runs. Game 2, hey, we don't have our fastball at the end. This is not great. Game 3, Minnesota swarms them with defense. Game 4, Denver reestablishes Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray in the first half. Unfortunately, they also got put back in the box in the second half because of Minnesota's defense. And then Ayo Dosunmu put himself in just historic praise with 40 points off the bench to help Minnesota win. The issue for Denver is you still have a shot in this series. You just have to win every single game, which is very tough. But if you look at what Denver built, and I think the most important thing, if we're talking about specifically the game five, 47 made field goals, shot 56% from the field, 47 made field goals, 35 assists. So we scored, and even though Jamal Murray was 9-23, Jokic was 9-15, didn't really hesitate a lot, got to the line, was able to create shots. And that is the dynamic you've been waiting for. So I know people are waiting to just kind of go to the top rope, elbow Jokic, and knock this at the park. But you forget the fact that when he does score, you eventually get to a position where do we want to defend this a certain way? We are sending help. He makes the right play. Like, that's the dynamic that is always ever present for Denver that makes him so special. The fact that he gets these type of buckets. And then, okay, we have to make a decision as a defense. Are we going to let him keep getting buckets? Or are we going to now show help and that opens up plays for others? I think Denver was able to just kind of tap on that over and over and over to a degree. And so, like, Jaden Daniels and Jamal Murray is one of my favorite matchups. Jaden Daniels cannot get in foul trouble, especially with no Anthony Edwards. And so you have the dynamic of Denver having a winning formula they can tap into, but they have no margin for error. And you have Minnesota, who has lost their people, has shown they can fight defensively, playing through Julius Randle, getting contributions from the bench is fantastic. Ayo has been good. Can we get enough offense? Can we get enough defense to just end this? We just need one. And so we're in an elimination game scenario. We go back home, we cook enough, it's over. It's over. We're done. We're advancing. We don't have to deal with you anymore. But if you're Denver, okay, is our offense rising each game? Do we have Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray playing at a higher level? Like, you credit Rudy Gobert and Jaden Daniels for the work they've done to poke at those two. But at the same time, if I'm Denver, if I can get those two back on the board, if I now can just sprinkle in enough defense with them not having all their people, can we just do this one more time? One time in Minnesota against an oiled up crowd, and now we get to a game 7 and we're both in the pressure cooker. So that's my full analogy.
Okay. You know what? I was a little alarmed by the very beginning, but you know what? You pulled it together. So I'm very impressed. I'd say before I get into like specific game vibes though, the end of game four, when we get the layup and then the brief antics, no suspensions, thank goodness that we didn't get any of that. That immediately leading into every time Jaden McDaniels touched the ball, just very loud boos. That's good crowd work. Like, that's what it's supposed to be. It doesn't have to be existential. Like, these teams don't like each other. It could just be that. So I thought that part was cool. That dichotomy was funny to me at the end of game four. The Denver's crowd responded. And then Jaden McDaniels getting an early foul trouble. That certainly didn't help. And the Nuggets win the game. So, like, that, we like gamesmanship on this podcast. So, like, that part is cool. To the other bit, getting Murray and Jokic back flowing was obviously important. It's probably the story of this game. I will say for Minnesota, you just can't, I'm sorry for boring analysis here, Steve. You cannot turn the ball over to the degree that you did in that first half. You did not give yourselves a lot of chance. Like, you just cannot do that. And like, thank goodness you were shooting the leather off the ball from deep to kind of compensate for it. But that's a very high bar to clear when you were turning the ball over on what felt like every other possession to start that game. It just cannot be that. I was impressed by the Julius Randle start and then equally dismayed by the ways they were turning the ball over and giving Denver chances. Now they hit the floor in transition, and then you get Murray and Jokic on the board on top of that. That's a lot to deal with when you don't have Anthony Edwards to come in and just say, actually, I'm just getting to the basket. Let's calm all this down. I get to a step back for you. Let's calm this all down. It's a little bit different when you're asking Ayo Dosunmu, Mike Conley, Terrence Shannon Jr. to be give you those kind of relief, calm us down buckets. You know what I mean? That's no disrespect to Mike Conley. But it's a little bit different in that regard. And as I was thinking about just this segment overall, just kind of are you cool? It's kind of wild. I'm glad we're starting with this series because you could ask this to both. Because on one hand, like Denver is still down and they do still have to claw themselves out of this deficit. On the other end, Minnesota, you only have to win one more time, but you have to do it without your starting backcourt. And I think without that added pressure, again, Anthony Edwards can just calm you down. Or as we talked about in pockets of game two, we really saw it in game three, to where, oh, we're just dinging you in this drop. I can just get downhill and force a lot of help, or I can just get to the line. We just put that kind of pressure on you, and then that loosens things up elsewhere. It opens up the cuts if you want to bring bigs to the level and things like that. Without Ant and not having a guy that's going to consistently get you two on the ball to that degree, I am curious to see what the half-court offense is going to look like. It does put a lot of emphasis on Minnesota to knock down a lot of pull-ups in this game to kind of loosen the shackles of their half-court offense. So I'm curious to see what that's going to look like in game six and moving forward. But... oh, man. Very fun Jokic game. Very fun Murray game. Just a big shout out to Spencer Jones coming in that way, because it's kind of like a late-ish scratch for Aaron Gordon, who has been trying his heart out to get out there on the floor. Like, the fact that he played in game four spoke to how much he wants to be there, how much he wants to help the team win, but it was clear that he was not moving super well in that one. So I'm kind of glad he was held out for game five. But for Spencer Jones to come in, like, I will shoot with confidence. I will cut. I will defend anyone. Just a huge night for him. 20 points, but many more plays that don't show up on the stat sheet there. Probably impact to Denver. Last question before we move. With no Aaron Gordon, we saw the return of the JB starting the second quarter minutes. Where is your confidence level in JB right now as we get to game six and game seven? And or game seven, I should say. Because those minutes feel like bellwethers for me.
It doesn't. You need someone to produce. And so from a coaching perspective, it's not necessarily how much my confidence level is. I need to make sure their confidence level is high based on the moment. Like, I think a lot of times when people talk about coaching decisions or lineup changes, a lot of the job is making sure that you understand what we're trying to do. But whenever the moment calls for you to be inserted back into the game, you are ready. And so it's just on JV to execute, do his job defensively, add something offensively. And then that's it. That's it. That's literally the bit.
Okay. Figured I'd get your thoughts before we move. Let's now move. We'll stay out west. The Los Angeles Lakers holding a 3-1 series.
This isn't a rhetorical question deal. This is just, I'm okay. I see what we're doing. Go ahead.
I think it's the Lakers. I had practice. A question for you. I had a question you answered. We did the job. We did the job. The Lakers on a 3-1 series lead right now. A 112-108 victory in game three in overtime because the Houston Rockets, who led by six with like 30 seconds left, did not close the deal. We will just leave it there in the interest of time. Lakers end up winning that game. Game four, the Houston Rockets responded in a big way. A 115-96 victory. A lot of turnover for the Los Angeles Lakers. Felt like the defense really led the dance for the Houston Rockets in this one. Some other smaller adjustments caught my eye in this game as well. But I'll pose the question to you, Steve. As the Rockets are still down 3-1, are they cooked? Or do you see a pathway for them getting back into this
one? They're cooked. And I've defended in the Rockets for a long time, but I'm tired of doing it, to be honest with you. And so it's a very tall task. You're tired of defending
the Rockets?
I am. It's a very tall task for them to find enough offense and defense to beat this Lakers team over and over again. And so I think with how LeBron James' mindset has been, what J.J. Redick has wanted to do coaching-wise, with the efforts that they've done and the potential that Austin Reaves returns, I don't see the Lakers necessarily missing out on this opportunity. If they do, we have a different conversation. But I'll be very quick, because I spent a whole podcast last week where you answered your own question and then you did not answer your own question. So I'm just going to say that the Rockets are cooked. I'm gonna join everyone else. I'm gonna say the Rockets are done. I don't feel like trying to explain what they do. It is what it is. A shout out to LeBron James.
Wow, I did not know this was gonna be the tenure of the segment. That's crazy. Well, one, I think JV can be helpful for the Denver Nuggets. There you go.
It's too late.
That's crazy. Too late. Okay. In all seriousness, Kevin Durant just not being available, trying his best to the point where he's getting treatment during a game, and then we get a prevailing narrative that he's I don't even want to spend time on that. But either way, KD working very hard to get back on the floor. If the lower body just isn't healthy enough, I do find it difficult to believe that the Rockets win three more games in this series. So, like, broader picture, like, I will say they are cooked. Do I think they can extend this window? I do. I do think this can get 2-6 or 2-7. Because I think game one, talked about it, wrote about it, the Lakers with the 111 half-court offensive rating. You get insane shot making from Luke Kennard, LeBron James playmaking all over the place, et cetera, et cetera. But since that game, the Rockets' defense has felt better as the series has gone on. They've continued to ramp up their physicality. They've continued to ramp up their switching. Now, it has been funny watching the Lakers relentlessly put Reed Shepard in action. But the Rockets, to their credit, have mostly navigated that, or at the very least, they did so in game five. Defense is feeling better.
I'm calling timeout. They did in the game five. They did not in the game. I mean, they did in game four. They did not in game three. Reed Shepard's defense was so bad, people thought that what he was doing was an intentional scheme from the Rockets, as opposed to him not being able to show him a cover.
That's fair. Game three, not great. Game four, I'm getting the four and the five from the previous series. But anyway, game four, weren't able to ding him to the same degree. So hat tip to you on that front. I think they can find enough. I haven't felt great about the Laker offense over the past couple of games. You're just zooming all the way out. Like, I think Houston has enough. They have the personnel to kind of box LA in a little bit more. And I think game four in particular, maybe not the volume of turnovers, but I think the level of switchability they saw, switches game of the series for Houston in game four. That is kind of what I envisioned heading into the series when you didn't have, especially when you factor in no Luka, no Austin Reaves yet. Though, early reporting from today from Sean Charani, Austin Reaves may be making his series debut in game five. So we'll see how that flips things for the Lakers side. I'm feeling better about this Rockets defense overall moving forward. And I think if they're able to win and transition in the way that they did in game four, I think if you get slightly better shot make from Alperen Sengun, and he's starting to look a little bit more comfortable as the series has gone on. And I think to the subtle adjustment point, like, it felt like more centralized touches for Alperen Sengun in that game four. Pick and roll, let's get him in the middle, elbow touches, or get him around the free throw line. The Lakers didn't show as much help, but I think part of that was where Alperen Sengun was catching the ball, where he was getting his shots off. Like, there was a little bit more intention, I think, for me in game four offensively. If they can lean into that, like, I do have some faith that they can get this to 6 or 7.
Okay, I'll ask one simple question. If we're talking about the Rockets, we're talking about, are they cooked? Did we take the chicken out of the fridge?
Yes. I'd say it's thawing out on the counter.
Okay. All right. All right. That's all I needed.
Now there may need to be a little bit more defrosting when it gets home. It might have been ooh, snap, I forgot. I was supposed to take this out this morning. But it is out. It is thawing. And that's where, again, I think Houston can extend this. I don't think you're coming back from 3-0. It's kind of where I'm at. So I do think the Lakers win the series overall, but I don't think it's over in five. I may take the L on that, but that's okay. Let's shift out to the Eastern Conference, Steve. The Boston Celtics with a 3-1 series lead. Game five happening a little bit later. A 108-100 victory for the Boston Celtics in game three, electrifying fourth quarter in that game in particular. Game four, Joel Embiid makes his return. And the Boston Celtics said, yeah, that's cool. 128-96 in that win. Steve, are the Philadelphia 76ers cooked in this series? Or is there anything they can do to turn this around?
Chopped up cheese whiz on some bread. It's not their fault. They tried their best. I think the problem is I would have loved if Joel Embiid came back in that game three, and I don't blame him. Like, he just literally had surgery very short time ago. But the mix of Philadelphia being able to have the answers they showed in the game two, plus reestablish Joel Embiid and have someone who can elevate them in the half court, I think would have put Boston in a different pressure box. By the time you got to game four, because Philadelphia was scrappy in that game three, They were into it in a way that you didn't necessarily expect. But you get to that game four and Boston says, actually, we're going to defend at a high enough level. And our offense, actually, we're going to knock on the door and we're going to execute and make the right plays, make the right reads. Peyton Pritchard is not going to stop. Like, Jason Tatum's going to go pick and roll, make the right pass every time. Like, we have had enough. And that happens to be the game that you brought Joel Embiid back, is the unfortunate part. And I think, you know, Joel Embiid being able to be someone who can hit these post-ups, who can pick and pop, it would have given Philadelphia a different layer they could hang their hat on in this series. But the fact that it came so deep in the series with Boston just kind of having we understand the assignment to a degree, tough blend. And so, yeah, I'll take some chips with the cheesesteak. It's fine.
Okay. Wow. Chips with the cheesesteak in particular. Oh my. Okay. So I just want to say, well, I guess one, to answer my own question, I do think Philly is kind of cooked in this one. I think Boston has just found a level of comfort on both ends. That's going to be tough. I think Joel Embiid is obviously good enough to kind of flip things on its head. In this game, he had 26-10. 26-10 and 6 at that, for that matter. But quieter game for Tyrese Maxey. Just the guard/wing room in general is a little bit quieter than you want them to be. I found it kind of funny, and I kind of want to ask you about this. So we had the loud game two for B.J. Edgecombe. In Boston, they haven't made many loud adjustments in this series. It has largely been, we're going to do what we do, and we're going to dare you to kind of beat us before we do anything different. We did go from Sam Hauser getting the initial VJ Edgecombe assignment to Jason Tatum getting the VJ Edgecombe assignment. And it is noteworthy to me that we had that. And it has been 16 combined points over the last two games for VJ Edgecombe. Now, Jason Tatum hasn't defended him for literally every possession of those two games, of course. But, like, that was a funny flip for me. In addition to just a little bit more intentional, we're keeping Tyrese Maxey down the sideline if we can. Let's keep him away from his right hand if we can. And so, like, Boston being able to find those notes and being able to mix in coverages and mix in matchups from there have been fun. It's hard for me to believe Philly can flip this to the degree to where, like, oh, they could get this to 7 and win it. So I am in the cook category. But I will just say, overall, we went into this series, like, not knowing what the health status for Joel Embiid was going to be, etc. Like, many people had Boston as a favorite in this series. This hasn't felt like a bad, like, Nick Nurse has blown this series for Philadelphia or anything. Like, I've generally been okay with what Philadelphia has attempted on both ends of the floor throughout this series. Like, this is very much Boston is playing better and is better to me. And to that end, Jason Tatum has just been phenomenal in this series. The playmaking for him, like, I don't know if I want to go and say, like, literally this is the best playmaking series he's ever had. But, like, it has felt like he is making decisions at the highest clip that I've seen him. Consistently, Philly not being able to answer to that portion, and then he can just sprinkle in these pull-ups whenever he wants to. It just makes life tough. All right, let's close this out with the West. The San Antonio Spurs leading their series against the Portland Trail Blazers 3-1. Game five also later tonight, a 120-108 victory in game three for the Spurs. A comeback win without Victor Wembanyama. Wemby makes his return in game four. It's a 114-93 win for the Spurs, in which the Blazers led by 17, I believe, at halftime. And by the time the fourth quarter started, it was tied. And then they just could not score anymore, and it went haywire. And Victor Wembanyama had 11 stocks in his return game. Are the Portland Trail Blazers cooked?
Baked.
Jeez. Okay. Fair enough. Like, I think I'm with you. Like, I do think they're cooked. And this, I say this somewhere, I'm just going to be wrong, because I had Spurs in 7. I thought the Blazers defense was going to do enough to make San Antonio uncomfortable. And I don't think for large stretches of this series, they have been able to do that. But the very loud and long stretches of offense, particularly in these past two games, where the Blazers just cannot knock down shots, cannot generate clean stuff in the half court, or at the very least, the open shots they get are shots that the Spurs are funneling behind the arc, and the Spurs are just able to run off of that. They just have not been able to sustain offense enough in this series. And so it's probably going to be Spurs in five versus Spurs in seven, like I had it heading into the series. It's just kind of tough for the Portland Blazer half-court offense. We now flip to the series that has already ended. So this is going to be more of a front, a forward-looking conversation here. OKC completing the sweep over the Phoenix Suns. 121-109 victory in game three, where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander loses his mind. A 131-122 victory in game four last night, where Shai once again loses his mind. Steve, can I drop a quick Shai Gilgeous-Alexander stat? The one that I saw on the broadcast, I believe. But since March 17th, so over a month and some change, in the fourth quarter of overtime, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is 19 of 23 from the field. He has missed four shots in the fourth quarter overtime in the past month. That is not how that is supposed to work. He had the one poor shooting game in game one, and since then, he has been able to dictate terms to the point where Phoenix has tried, we're going to blitz you, we're going to switch you, here's some Oso Iguodaro, let's put more size on you, Dylan Brooks, you start the series guarding Chet Holmgren, now we're going to put you on Shai, let's see if you can do anything about it. He's just been unstoppable. And so the series is over. Broader question, I think, from the Phoenix side, great season for them overall, obviously isn't the result for them. They are entering an offseason and just moving forward, like they don't have a ton of first round pick equity and things like that. How do you feel about their direction moving forward? How do you feel about their ability to build off of what this season was?
How could you feel bad about the direction? They weren't supposed to be here. I mean, I think once they kind of get locked into the play-in atmosphere, it was going to be tough sledding because you're facing either Oklahoma City's defense or San Antonio's defense. So there was a potential for this to be a Rockets adjacent season before they got Kevin Durant, where, okay, we are now being tested and understand what we need to build to be able to have success in the playoffs. But you're way ahead of schedule based on what what you had before, what you had to pivot towards, and what you have now. So I think it's just refining the roster. You have a coach that understands exactly what he wants to do on both ends of the floor. So just getting the right pieces around it, having a level of versatility, that's all you got to do. So I think it's a salute to Phoenix. It's unfortunate it went this way in the playoffs, but the Thunder are a machine, and it was a bad matchup as far as they took everything off the menu for you offensively. And if you don't have the offense, you can't be annoying on defense, and you have to live with it.
Yeah. You match up with the MVP, you're just going to have a tough time. Look, I was excited about this matchup just because of what these defenses have done to each other throughout the regular season matchups, but it did just get kind of tough. Like Grayson Allen made his series debut in game four, for example, if you're talking about three-point shooting and trying to unlock more of the offense for Phoenix. So that part was tough. I feel generally good about what Phoenix was able to establish. Again, like the pick equity kind of is what it is. You get your first real look at Jalen Green in a playoff setting as like a number two or sometimes a number three if Dylan Brooks is taking all the shots. And it's like, I like some of the flash that we saw from him. Was over 20 points per game during the series. I think 47 true shooting. You don't want that. But when you are facing an OKC defense like this, like, I don't know how much I mostly want to salute OKC more than like yell at Jalen Green for any of that. So like, I generally feel good. I think being able to set the culture on both ends of the floor should make it easier to kind of find these other pieces to slide into what Phoenix wants to do. I'm excited to see how they build off of that. And with that, we are going to take a break. And when we return, we shift to the W. We have preseason action to talk about and react to some more preseason action happening later this week. We're going to have some fun. Stick with us. And we're back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, it is time to talk about some WNBA preseason action. We finally have games to talk about, to discuss, get some early glimpses at some of these teams. Let's start with the New York Liberty taking on the Indiana Fever. The Fever with a 109-91 victory in this one. No Aaliyah Boston, no Lexi Hull, no Ty Harris for the Fever. No Satu Sabi debut yet. No Leonie Feverish for the New York Liberty. So we didn't get to see the full starting lineups for both of these teams, but we did get to see some key figures in this one. And so just broadly, want to toss it to you, Steve. What were some of your bigger takeaways from this one? What did you see? What did you like?
I think the biggest thing when you talk about the Indiana Fever, they are flowing and they are pushing the basketball at all times whenever they can. And so get the ball up the court and go, and, you know, getting pin downs for Kelsey Mitchell, getting Caitlin Clark in scenarios where she's throwing the ball ahead, trying to just push and generate as much pace as they can. I don't even like using the word pace, but they were really trying to get up and down the floor. I was intrigued by just some of the different things they were able to do as far as, you know, all right, if a team wants to pressure Caitlin Clarke and I, we flow into our actions, we play out of it. Kelsey Mitchell setting screens on ball for Caitlin Clarke was interesting. But again, the fact that they were just kind of able to mix different things in for Caitlin Clarke and try to avoid having her dribble the ball up every time and get a throw ahead, get her some more pass and catch and where she can get downhill and then set up a pick and roll. And now you have to deal with them in a different way. So the flow that the Fever can maintain is where my eyes are kind of going as far as preseason and early season. Like, obviously, no Leah Boston, but what are you going to do when Caitlin Clarke's not on the court? And are you going to be committed to being able to go side to side? And so I think there were some possessions where they were able to kind of say, okay, here's a Caitlin Clarke pick and roll. We're going to advance to the next side. It's an empty side pick and roll. You have to defend that. If you defend that well, you kick it again, you know, especially Moni Billings being in the corner and Moni Billings having the ability to stretch the floor. But also, I can get to a dribble handoff. We can keep our flow going. Here's Caitlin Clarke. You get the ball again. And so the fact that they can keep pressure on teams is very interesting to me. And so I'm intrigued by that. And so I really like the Monique Billings fit. I think I like what Maisha Hines-Allen can bring to the table for Indiana as far as building on what they wanted to have last year, but having a little bit more versatility in the sense that we can keep the floor space, we can get to multiple actions, we can kind of play out of the play. And so I think for me with the Fever, it's just, okay, can we get Raven Johnson to a level? Can we continue to blend Caitlin Clarke and Kelsey Mitchell? Can we just keep a level of force in the half court to where you have to deal with us not only in transition when we get stops, but you are going to have to guard us in the half court? I think that's got to be the goal for the Fever. I think they showcase themselves pretty well as far as having the spacing and the blend of the attacks. The Liberty, on the other hand, is interesting. You know, a lot of the talk was whole new offense. They tried the five out thing last year, so this isn't like completely brand new to a degree. I think there was an intentionality that the Liberty had offensively that felt a little bit different as far as, hey, would you like to screen for Breanna Stewart? Jonquel Jones, would you like to set a screen? We go big, big. Sabrina, would you like to set a screen? We go big, big, big. We go guard, guard. Benajah, would you like to screen for Sabrina? Like, there's different ways that they kind of get to their flow. So how it evolves to me is going to be key. They're going to need flow. They're going to need tempo. They're going to need execution. But with their roster, they have a level of versatility and they have pressure points you have to deal with, especially if you consider at some point Satu Sabli will be on this team. And so it's eventually going to become, we have spacing and we have an ability to flow into different actions. And do you want to switch this? How do you want to cover this specific action? And so the moments where they were running Sabrina, hey, dribble handoff to Stewie, and she just kind of drives left. And that's tough to deal with to a degree. A lot of Iverson cuts for Sabrina Ionescu. And okay, we go to side pick and roll. It's an empty side. The top of the key is empty and the person on the wing is Breanna Stewart. So how much help do you want to show at the nail? Does that open up space for Sabrina? Does that open up space for the roller? Like, I think those are the intriguing pieces when it comes to what Olivia are trying to build up. Like, where are people spaced? How do things kind of go? But I think they're trying to kind of keep pressure on teams in a different way as far as, do you want to deal with this? Do you want to handle us? The defense was intriguing. Like, Jonquel and more of a drop was interesting to me. They still have the same game plan with Sabrina, where if Sabrina gets clipped, actually, I'm out of here.
I'm getting out of here.
someone please take this roller. I will get to the perimeter, but please get that out there. So it's fantastic. Hanzu, I don't know if people are unfamiliar with Hanzu. But just know there's no time to be wasted. There's no games to be played. Hanzu is here to get buckets. And them putting out a lineup of Hanzu, Jonquel, Stewie, Benajah, and Sabrina filled my heart with joy as far as, you know what, Han? You go ahead in space. That's fine. Don't even worry about it. You get the ball, let it fly. So I think it's more the Liberty showcasing and trying to work out their versatility. So good effort from both teams. Kind of just give us an idea of what they're trying to do.
Okay, I like it. I like it. I think for me, I think you nailed it with the Fever trying to maintain their tempo and their pace for that matter. We want to get the ball up quick with the hit aheads. We don't want Caitlin getting pressured 90 plus feet from the basket all the time. And if you can, we can just hit this ahead to see what that looks like. And watching the side-to-side flow was fun. Like, Sobey Cunningham came out on fire from deep in this one. Kelsey Mitchell got downhill early. You saw the mix of cutting on top of this. And I guess just to quickly broaden the scope, like, normally, Steve, I think we have the understanding, like, your star player in your franchise is going to have some level of say when it comes to, like, free agency stuff. Like, hey, here's a name I like, whatever. Caitlin Clarke might have literally written the Monique Billings contract. You know what I mean? Like, I think the Team USA played with those two. I think Caitlin recognized very quickly, oh, she screams, she slips out of here. This very quick. We have immediate chemistry. Like, it popped in their very first possession of Team USA qualifying play. Did not surprise me at all that we got early in the free agency process in Monique Billings. You were signing with the Indiana Fever. Like, Caitlin might have called her herself to do that. But in all seriousness, it was fun to watch those two. The showcase more of their early chemistry with the inside actions. We got, you mentioned the handoff hub stuff with Monique Billings. We got a fake handoff from Monique as she gets all the way downhill though on the right side of the floor. And it's like, okay, if you have a big that can do that, that also like it makes it tougher to load up on Caitlin if you have a big that is comfortable putting the ball on the floor to that degree. And so like that part popped for me. I would like to talk about Raven Johnson because buddy, like anyone that can defend like that all already gets me excited. And like she is a guard that has like the ridiculous wingspan on top of that, so there's like a level of positional versatility in addition to like her being smart off the ball and being able to navigate screens. So then she just has limbs that you have to navigate on top of that. Her plumbing off the bench 17 minutes plus 14 in 17 minutes, so like yes, three stocks and just multiple other possessions defensively where it's like you could just feel opposing guards trying to figure out, okay, where am I dribbling? Where am I taking the shot? She is mirroring me. She's navigating. She's on my hip now. I don't know how much room I actually have here. Anything on the backside, if she's off the ball, like, can I actually throw this pass? Because she might be here. Like, I'm trying. There was one pass in particular. End up being like a foul or some kind of whistle being blown in place that didn't count. But like, it's like an entry pass. And she's flying in from the left corner to steal a pass. I'm just like, what do you do with that? And so, as I mentioned on Friday, I want to see, like, what her aggression looks like. She did indeed see switches. She did indeed see some unders. And so, it was nice to see, I think, late first quarter, I want to say there was one possession. New York tries to mix in the under. She just beats it with a drive, gets all the way downhill. It's like, okay, that's the aggression you want to see. Obviously, you want the efficiency to carry on with that as well. But, oh, she's just going to impact winning basketball, man. To defend, to be able to play make, she's going to be a part of that initiation package if she's sharing the floor with Caitlin Clark, so she doesn't have to bring it up all the time. She's going to be able to table set. I love the fit when the pick was announced and just got to see some of the early seeds. I was just very excited about what the Raven Johnson experience was for Indiana. As far as other scheme things, like, again, the flow they want to get to, you nailed that. Defensively, one of the things I mentioned Friday, the Fever were one of the like high pickup teams defensively. I want to see if they did that. That felt more dialed back than what we saw last year, so I don't know if that was just, hey, we are playing the Liberty, we can't really do that, or if Stephanie White actually wants to dial that back a little bit to start the year. So still keeping an eye on that. That part was interesting to me. On the Liberty side, I too enjoyed the spacing elements here. Again, as you mentioned, not new that they went five out because they did it last year, but like the fact that one of the things I had in my notes, like, oh, we are 3 minutes into this game. Breanna Stewart has brought the ball up. Benajah Laney Hamilton has brought the ball up. Sabrina Ionescu has brought the ball up, and they've been able to flow into different screening actions from there on and off the ball. And so, like, having that level, having those kind of triggers in half court with the way they're spacing and that amount of talent is naturally going to be tough. And once you add Satu Sabli into this mix, it's going to be even tougher. So I'm excited to see what that part looks like. Within that spacing, like, I was just kind of keeping an eye on, like, okay, how are they respacing here? If you do have an action, what are they trying to do here? It just felt like a lot of one player starts in the left corner. I now shift all the way to the right corner while action's being developed. Everyone kind of rotates around that. And so, like, peeping the timing of that to make sure that when the roll happens or whatever, that it's still clean, you can take advantage of that kind of spacing. Felt mostly good in that game, at least in the first half when you had starters out there. So I like that part from New York. I'm glad you brought up the jumbo lineup because it felt like something to joke about heading into that game. And then we just legit saw Stewie at the three with Jonquel and Hanzu out there together. That – I don't know if that should be allowed. That's a lot of size. That's insane. But Hanzu, 20 points, I believe, off the bench. I think she was more than willing to let it fly and get those buckets. Had a nice post fade, sprinkled in three. Like it, she was just did not take her long to get integrated. Keeping an eye on Benajah Laney Hamilton. Obviously, her first action in a while, and so just seeing like how quickly she gets back to peak form defensively is going to take a little bit. But like some of the initiation, like some of the passes she was trying, even though they some of those ended in turnovers. But interesting start for both of these teams. Result doesn't really matter to me, but I like the attempts from both sides conceptually. Let's move quickly to the Los Angeles Sparks. Took on the Nigerian national team, an 89-63 victory there. We didn't get the Neko Gumake debut / return in this one. No Ray Burrell either. But that did give us the opportunity to get an early look at Erica Willer plus Kelsey Plum in the backcourt. They started with Erica Willer, Kelsey Plum, Ariel Atkins, who boy, we'll get there. great game for her, in my opinion. De'Arcy Hamby and Cam Brink as your starting lineup, and seeing some of those attempts, starting with the offense for me, Kelsey off ball is always a good time. Like, if she doesn't have to be the one to bring it up, and she can just attack off of a pin down or any kind of quick action, get a full head of steam before getting downhill, like, she is just that much more difficult to deal with. And so seeing those early reps, and then her being mixed in as a cross-screener for Cam Brink to set up some mid-range shots for Cam Brink, some low post touches. I was curious to see, like, what the shot diet for Cam Brink was going to be overall in this one. So using Kelsey in that way to generate some easier shot attempts for her, I thought that was good stuff. Ariel Atkins slotted in nicely her first made basket as a spark, stationed in the right corner. You get Kelsey, De'Arcy Hamby, two-player action. Kelsey gets downhill, help creeps in on De'Arcy Hamby roll. Easiest shot of her life for Ariel Atkins. Very easy to see how she slots in. And defensively, taking on tough assignments, flying around off the ball. I think 3 steals in this game, but just multiple other possessions where she's just mucking stuff up on the back end. Very impressive start for that starting group and with those stars in general. So, like, the early seeds were pretty positive for me. But, Steve, I'll flip it to you. What did you like from this Los Angeles Sparks? What kind of stood out to you in that matchup?
What you said. I mean, just building on that, you saw the building blocks of what the Sparks want to do. So being able to have Kelsey Plum move around the board, being able to kind of trust Cameron Brink in different moments and get some cross screens, get some movement to get her involved offensively, and saw Ariel Atkins have an impact defensively and also be able to play off ball. So good stuff from the Sparks. Good start.
Okay, there we go. Other thing I want to add before we move. The Taniya Latson debut, 7 points, 5 rebounds, 6 assists, had a block in 22 minutes off the bench for her. And it is tough to be a WNBA guard because the league is just incredibly tough. And so, like, watching the first stint for her and how it ended, where you get to the end of the first quarter and she's trying to thread this needle on this pass and transition, where you can see on the broadcast what she saw, but the pass gets deflected, it's stolen. Team Nigeria ends up scoring towards the end of the first quarter. On the other end, so that just ends up being a swing. Start of the second quarter wasn't that great. She goes to the sideline, and the camera cuts to Lynn Roberts talking to Taniya Latson. It wasn't like she was, like, ripping into her or anything like that. Just very much like, hey, this is what we're seeing. Let's calm this down a little bit, et cetera, et cetera. And so for her to bounce back from what her initial stint was in that basketball game to the way that she was able to close, and where you see the drives pop off the screen, the playmaking based off of those drives pop off the screen, just some of the easy decisions she was able to make as a ball mover. Pop, and she got after it defensively as well. I love seeing that kind of resilience from any guard, but especially like a rookie guard in this kind of situation. So I want to give a salute to Taniya Latson there. And just in general, like, this felt like a good challenge for the Sparks to kick off this preseason. Like, Team Nigeria, if you're going to watch them, they're going to drive the basketball a bunch. So you're going to get an early test on how well you can contain drives. And they're going to be a team that is not afraid to ramp up full court pressure against you and just pressure your guards. And so good reps all around. But impressive stuff from the start. Kelsey Plum, 22 points in 21 minutes. Just, she was on fire from the beginning and just did not stop. But quick salutes there to the Los Angeles Sparks. Want to see more of Taniya, see how that builds out. We now move to the Phoenix Mercury and the Chicago Sky, a 108-104 victory for the Mercury in that basketball game. No Monique Okoro-Emekanne for Phoenix. No Azrae Stevens, Elizabeth Williams, Courtney Vandersloot, Dejanay Carrington, Maddie Westbell for the Chicago Sky. But that does mean we get to see interior focal point Camilla Cardoso. We got to see Rakia Jackson make her debut as well. And on the Mercury side is Alyssa Thomas and Kalia Copper kind of lead the dance now with Satu Sabli now in New York. So, Steve, we'll toss it to you. What were some of your bigger takeaways from that matchup?
No, how did you feel about the Sky? Do you feel like they were able to execute their vision, Nikaias?
Yes, and it was interesting to see some of the subtle shifts with their offense, more so like the secondary flow of their offense. Because I think last year with Angel and with Camilla, if their initial action didn't work, you would see one of them flash and then they get to initiate a handoff or just some kind of flow there. And it felt like in this preseason matchup, it was a lot more, here's our initial action, whatever it is. Camilla Cardoso now above the break, I'm going to be used more as a pick and roll screener more than a hub. Let's just get into another ball screen and let's dive. Let's have some fun with that. And then you get into some space clearing for those roles for Camilla. So, like, it was fun watching that early start for her in particular. I think she made her first 3 or 4 shots in that game. And a lot of that was off of her putting pressure on the defense and pick and roll. So, like, I like that portion. Defensively, I am keeping an eye on it. It felt a little more, at least in terms of like the big coverages, it felt a little bit more conservative more seeds of like what the second half of last year was compared to we're having our bigs at the level and then we can mix in switches and things like that. Felt more drop adjacent to me. So that part was interesting. You got to see very early on what the ball pressure and physicality off the ball was going to look like. Skylar getting after it, JC Sheldon getting after it, Gabriella Jaquez as she checks in getting after it. And so you certainly feel that level of emphasis on the defensive end. So like, I think you got to see like what they are trying to accomplish, how they want to guard. I'm excited to see whenever we do get the Azrae Stevens debut, like how she slots into this. Does she start? If so, is she taking up some of the pick and roll reps from Camilla? Like how is she spacing? Like there are more things I want to see for Chicago, of course, but I think pretty clear what they were trying to accomplish on both ends of the floor. How did you feel about it?
Did you feel good about what the Mercury were trying to do? Or was this they're just doing continuity?
It felt more of the latter. Like, again, obviously no Satu, there is going to be more touches. So for me, it felt like a lot more split action type stuff with Alyssa Thomas. And then Kalia Copper just letting it fly to that degree. Like the box score is going to be loud. 19 points in what, 16 minutes, I think it was, or something to that degree for Kalia Copper. But I do think if you're just going to see more of Alyssa Thomas and Kalia Copper in action together in general, like I'm excited about what that can look like. And because of the way that, one, the Mercury invert the floor, and two, the shooters that they want to have in these lineups alongside those two, it opens up a lot of secondary fun. Like, to the Chicago defense point, they got hit a lot with off-ball screens and then slips. Or when they did get into the split actions, we're going to dive, you don't know who's picking up who. The Sky were trying to tap into a level of switching. They couldn't get a handle on it for the first half of that basketball game. That is a that is a level of continuity for what Phoenix wanted to do. But like being able to hammer that part home more now when you have this kind of pick, this kind of pull-up equity with Ka in action with AT. I don't want to go too far and be like, oh, he's going to be even more dangerous because that feels slightly disrespectful to what Satu is as a player. But that does feel like a button I'm excited to see press a little bit more. And like some of the weak side action paired with what those two can do and like the pull-up equity that Ka has, especially if she's going to be more willing to take threes off the bounce, I'm very excited about what that can look like.
Fantastic. Would you like to talk about the Lynx and the Mystics?
We can. We can. We had a 77-66 win for the Minnesota Lynx in this one. I'm excited about the Olivia Miles experience, Steve, on the Minnesota side. And obviously the Washington Mystics with a ton of youth in this basketball game. It's like Olivia Miles pick and rolls. This is cool. Sonya Citron, you were second spectrum had her at logging 7 post-ups during the regular season last year. It felt like she had 7 in that open preseason game against the Minnesota Lynx. Fun basketball game, even as we got like deeper into the rotation in the second half of that game. Shout out Aubrey Griffin and the others leading that run for Minnesota in the second half of that game. It was a fun basketball game for me. What were some of your takeaways from this one?
I mean, I think the big thing is looking at the Washington Mystics and what they can build with youth. I think the defensive potential of Lauren Betts was really intriguing to me. I think the positioning that she has, the timing that she has as far as being able to be in that drop, be in the right spot, having active hands is something that people should keep an eye on because I think she's got a lot of growth that she can hit in that area, especially as games go on. There was second quarter, a couple reps where she held a little bit too long in that drop, but I think it was a pretty impressive do your job type performance. There are opportunities for the Mystics to play through her at the top of the key and get some more off ball movement. Moving Sonya Citron around the board is interesting as far as being able to get her some off ball screens, try and tap into some of the growth on ball that we saw in Unrivaled, but not necessarily needing to build the boat around that. And so, you know, the shooting can exist. We know the attacks exist. Let's try and get her off ball. Let's get her some backdoor cuts, let's get some post-ups. So it's just, okay, the intrigue of the Mystics and what they can be. I think Georgia Amore, a reminder of how fun of a player she is with the confidence and the moxie and the willingness to kind of get after it. So I think it's a glimpse. Like, I think young teams are typically a different deal in the W, but I think the Mystics are able to kind of build something organically, and shout out to the effort that Roy Harmon gave in her minutes as far as the energy and the activity. But I was really impressed with Lauren Betts as far as, okay, if I get a mismatch, it's going to be really hard for you to deal with me in the post. I can get one of these defensively. You may think I'm not doing certain things, but I am nailing certain assignments. So intrigued to see how that goes. Cody McMahon was very active. Loved the drives, loved the activity. And so I think the Mystics are an intriguing bunch of young talent.
No, I like it. Like, quickly to the Lauren Betts portion, I think this was a conversation that was had like pre-draft overall, like her with W spacing, can we get even more of the playmaking unlocked in this setting? And you saw it very early on. Let's get her touch at the free throw line or near the elbow area. Let's cut around that. Let's see what we can get out of it. Got an early assist, I think, Sonya Citron out of that. They run the progression a little bit later. It's like, okay, cool. Now we're just going to flow into a handoff. We run it a little bit later. We flow into a pick and roll. And that turns into like a late dive later in the clock. And so like the fact that you can build things around Lauren Betts without it feeling like we are slowing everything down and it is just the Lauren Betts show. Like that is the balance that you want if you're Washington. And she's obviously talented enough to, one, just seal players that are smaller than her and get fruitful shots. And the playmaker is going to unlock things for everyone else to take some of the pressure off of Sonya Citron. You know, we didn't get to see Kiki. I'm curious to see like what some of those high-low looks are going to look whenever we do get those minutes. Same, similar bit with Shakira Austin whenever we get to see her as well. So like, I like the early seeds there. I'm glad you hit on the Cody McMahon drives because, good Lord, not only did she get downhill with some of these like low handoffs or low pick and rolls, like the shoulder bumps to create space on some of these finishes. She let everyone hear about it after some of these finishes and fouls and drawing fouls. I'm just excited to watch her in this system. And so, you know, similar to the conversation we had on Friday, like I have my general spacing concerns, but this is a team that is comfortable running their stuff low on the floor and putting pressure on defenses in a different way. And like, you got to see seeds of that in this basketball game. And like quickly to the Minnesota side, like I start with Olivia Miles because naturally like top three pick, you want to see what that looks like. I am still kind of cackling at, I think, end of the first quarter or second quarter, whichever one it was. Let me get fancy. What a pass. It is immediately deflected and gone the other way. And my immediate thought was like, I can't wait to see what Cheryl Reeve does or says about this. We just kind of let her play through it. I guess with Minnesota overall, like seeing Olivia Miles in game one versus seeing her against the Nigerian national team last night, seeing the turnovers get cut down, I think that is a positive. And I think in general, like her pacing and visioning pick and roll pops, this isn't new. But one of the things that I tweeted out is I was threatening the misses game in particular. It's like her strength as a driver and her strength on rejects already raises my brow. Because I don't think that's a thing that's easy to establish early on as you're dealing with WNBA players and their level of strength. The fact that you can set up these ball screens, get to the other side, deal with someone on your hip and still get to your spot and get to favorable shots at the rim. And because she is so comfortable making these live dribble reads, that's also unlocked. You can get into some of the weak side skips to the corner. You can get into some of the late dives from the corner. You saw one of those in the Mystics game as well. I'm just very impressed with what she looked like. The other thing that I will sprinkle in on the Lynx front, with Eliska Hamzova, she puts her head down all of the time. Very, very much a fan of her drives early on. So I want to sprinkle in the Lynx thoughts there. And then finally, Steve, the Aces taking on the Japan's women's national team, a 94-78 victory there. I was in the building for that one. Two loudest moments from the crowd within that game. One was pregame, as Asia Wilson didn't play. She's going through her pregame warm-up, usual spiel, doing her drills, etc. As she does when she caps things off, she revs up, backs up towards half court, and she just sprints through the tunnel back to the locker room. Crowd loses their mind every time she does it. No change there. Other loud moment for me, Kennedy Carter checks in for the first time. And you would have thought Asia, like, surprisingly checked into this game with the way the crowd lost their mind. This fan base is so excited to embrace Kennedy Carter and everything she could bring. And for her to immediately check in and get two offensive rebounds, it's like, okay, so it's not just the scoring stuff. She can buck things up in that degree. You also saw the drive. She gets a first basket on the transition look. And so you see that there. Obviously, I have a lot of Aces thoughts, but I flip to you. What were some of the things that stood out to you as you watched this
one? You were live and in person. Deliver your Aces thoughts, buddy.
Okay, well, 30 points allowed in the first quarter because Japan was firing away from deep. And as the Aces were looking to switch a lot of things, especially when they went into their bench, those switches were not always as clean as you want them to be. A lot of gaps between those switches, and I think that's where you saw a lot of pull-up shooting. And again, Japan is not afraid at all to let it fly. And so, like, watching them kind of tighten the screws from the second quarter onward, I think was encouraging. I think just, I guess, zooming into the starting lineup, Chelsea Gray looked very comfortable early on. I can get to my spots. I can get to these pull-ups in particular. Jackie Young, same thing. If I see drop, I don't mind snaking this pick and roll, keeping someone on my hip, getting to pull-up twos. It feels like she wants that to be a bigger part of her game. And so I'm curious to see what the blend of pull-up twos versus pull-up threes versus actual rim attempts will be for Jackie Young. That was a question I had last year, but similar bit heading into this season as well. Early pick and roll chemistry between Jackie Young and Melissa Smith. That was fun to watch develop. You get to the backup big situation for the Aces. I was a very big fan of the Bree Turner experience in this basketball game. very strong screens on and off the ball to help pry the other aces open. Defensively, I'm going to be part of the switching package and you're not going to have fun. Looked it up on Second Spectrum. She defended 13 on-ball picks in this game, in this basketball game, switched most of them. Japan scored 0 points on those possessions. And she was a part of a lot of those stops. It wasn't just I switch one and the action goes elsewhere and they miss a shot. Like, she was directly involved in a lot of these and did her job mirroring in space and testing shots and ultimately blocking a couple of shots as well. So very encouraging there. Cheyenne Parker-Tai has got a stint in the first and the second quarter. Second quarter stint, which went much better than the first quarter stint. Did not see her in the second half. As we turned to soak up a lot of those minutes, you also saw a little bit more Janiyah Barker late, though Janiyah, towards the end of the fourth quarter, she's fighting through a screen, head slash shoulder area into like the knee of a Japan player. She is currently in concussion protocol, so we'll see when she's going to be available again. But clearly a little bit more switching defensively. Nalissa Smith, we got to see her as she started. No Asia Wilson. She was the nominal five for the starting lineup. So a lot more drop than I anticipated. I figured she would have been either part of switching or they would have had her up to the level, just kind of used the size and activity there. But they had her in a drop, pretty inconsistent rhythm there. Box score won't show up, but like, I mostly enjoyed the Stephanie Talbot experience. Like, you clearly see that she's processing the floor very quickly. So any kind of advantage. There were a few possessions where Japan kind of flowed into like a hybrid zone look, and she did a really good job of finding space, keeping the ball moving, making quick passes out of that. So like, I think she's going to slide in. She held up relatively well defensively outside of like one short range turnaround in the first quarter. Someone pulled the brakes on her on that front. But overall, like, a solid effort from the aces, clearly some growth areas defensively. Becky Hammon talked a lot about what the defense looked like and how much better it needs to be. But you see what they're trying to flow into offensively, defensively, structurally, you see what they want to get to. So those were some of my thoughts. And the actual last one we want to talk about, we're flowing into the future slate. Circle back to the Golden State Valkyries defeating the Seattle Storm 78-76. No Gabby Williams debut quite yet. Golden State missing quite a few regulars in this one. Seattle, no Alfam, no Ezzie Mabigore yet. Natisha Hydman, Jordan Horston, and Kalu Samuelson also out. So again, get some key figures in there, but not the full assortment of talent. And I just wanted to see, for the most part, because I alluded to this on Friday, I wanted to see what Seattle looked like on both ends of the floor, what they wanted to try under Sonya Rahman. And it didn't feel like demonstrably different from last year scheme-wise. I will say, like, it was a similar bit to the New York point I made with their spacing. We're like, okay, we're clearing these corners. We're relocating. We're wheeling around on that front as we set up our action. So, like, that part was intriguing to me. We did see a little bit of Dom on ball, but not as much as I anticipated. But seeing some of the drives pop in the half court and some of the self-creation reps were a lot of fun for me on the Seattle side. And then from there, like, Flaje Johnson just kind of popped off the screen for me athletically. It was not all perfect. I am going to keep an eye on what the off-ball defense looks like, as I do with most rookies. A little over-eagerness there. Golden State with some sideline set pieces. Like, let's set a bat screen on Flaje. Let's see if she's ready to switch or she's ready to navigate. They were able to generate some good shots out of that. And so keep an eye on that portion. But on ball, you can see the juice that she has as a driver. And on those possessions where you're able to set up some kind of off-ball screen or get her flowing into a handoff before attacking, you just see the explosiveness in some of the drives and some of the mid-range shot making that she can get into. One of the highlights for her from this game. I tried to attack to her right, ends up stepping back, making the step back three. I was like, ooh, keeping an eye on the handle, but being able to adjust like that on the fly and get into that kind of shot making late in the clock, also impressive to me. So excited for the Flaje experience in this. I think as Seattle is able to be a little bit more consistent defensively, get some stops, like, you'll see that pop more in transition. So that part's going to be fun for me. Golden State, major notes for me. You're always going to keep an eye on the three-point shooting with Veronica Burton. Her being willing to pull from deep and being willing to pull from deep off the bounce, if that's a continuation from what we saw towards the latter stages of last year, that is super exciting to me. Like, she already feels like fringe all-star, fringe all-W player to me anyway, based on the drives, the playmaking, the defense. If she's adding that on top of everything else, like, she's just going to be one of the best guards that we have in the league. So I'm excited to see what that portion looks like. But that'll be the major notes from me at the very least, Steve. What popped for you in this matchup?
Mila Soa was fun. So it'll be intriguing to see if that's an offensive trigger that the Valkyries can hit. Nice to be back in Valhalla. So the defense is very active. I think for the Storm, it's one of those things where, okay, how are you going to build this? What are you trying to attack? Can you get a base defensively? Can you get a base offensively? So we'll see how that grows going forward. But I think if you're talking about preseason action for both teams, you got to feel excited about what you're building towards.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. So now we have more preseason action happening on Wednesday and Thursday. We can react to that on Friday. But 10 teams have played. The other five are going to be making their preseason debuts. So, Steve, on Wednesday, we have the Connecticut Sun taking on the Toronto Tempo. You start there. What are some things you're looking forward to in that particular matchup or just in general during this preseason stretch for these teams?
It's preseason basketball, so let's see what the attempts are.
Fair enough. Okay, I will say on the Connecticut side, we always have to wait for like what the injury reports and who what the overseas commitments are going to be. But I think generally speaking, like how does Layla Lacan build on what the second half of that season was? Like what kind of shooting does she add to the drives to the defense? What does Saniya Rivers look like offensively? As we saw her experiment a little bit with the shot creation during the unrivaled season, but can she build on that because the defense is already all world? And just in general, how are they mixing in the bigs and for Toronto Tempo? Hey, man, I'm just excited to see what this team looks like, first and foremost. But we're going to get some Marina plus Brittany Sykes minutes, I would imagine. What does that portion look like? Going to be keeping an eye on the Kiki Rice debut. Like, what is her offensive progression going to look like on that front? So I'm excited to see how those team meshes up, how those teams mesh up. Because I think just in general, Toronto, that Toronto backcourt versus the level of defenders that Connecticut can throw out there, that's a good early test. So I'm excited about that one. We're going to get Dream Sky, which is, I guess, technically the Angel Reese revenge game early on. It's preseason, so I don't know if that really counts as the revenge game. But either way, we get to see that. We've seen the Sky so far. With the Atlanta Dream, again, no Bree Jones for a little bit. I am more than anything looking to see, like, one, how often is Angel going to be asked to initiate things, either off of misses or just within the half-court flow? Like, what is the touch volume going to be? And then bigger thing for me is defensively. Is this going to be more of an at-the-level defense since Bree Jones is out? Are we going to have Angel in the drop? Is Nyles Hillman going to be in the drop? Are they going to lean more into switching? Do we see any kind of fun cross-matching with this team? And, like, assuming Camila Cardoso is going to also start and play in this game, like, that is a pretty sizable matchup at the five room. So, like, are they going to send doubles in any kind of way? Or, like, how they handle, like, I'm pretty much Atlanta Dream defense peel in this particular matchup. What are you excited to see with this Atlanta group?
What are you trying to see from the Chicago Sky in game two?
I want to see if the usage from Rekia Jackson shifts at all. Like, it felt like a nice mix of ISO stuff, post-up stuff, give some handoffs, some early pick and roll. She got to bring the ball up a few times as well in that opener. And so, like, do they refine any of that volume or are they just truly letting her spread her wings on that front? That part is going to be interesting to me. I think Camila, like, one, if she does not foul out, we're going to see just a larger stretch. Like, how does the defense build? I think it was an inconsistent production piece defensively for her. So, like, how does she build on that? Do we see any more of a coverage mixture on that front? Those probably be the primary things that I'm looking for on the Chicago's front. The other games we have on Wednesday, we have the Portland Fire also making their debut, the Seattle Storm in game two for them. Is it unfair to say, like, I just want to see Bridget Carlton in this element, just more usage in general? Like, this is going to be my first time in earnest in the W, just seeing her outside of the Minnesota context. And so, like, what freedom is she going to be given on this front? Is it going to be similar to, like, they're different players, but is it going to be similar to Kayla Thornton in Golden State last year, where it's like, okay, this is a lot more mid-range creation than I was thinking from Kayla Thornton, in addition to, like, the defense and the dirty work that she normally does. For Bridget Carlton, is she running a high dosage of pick and rolls? Is it going to be, like, a lot of pitch and catch for her? Is it just going to be heightened three-point volume? Like, that is probably where I start. And then, of course, broader strokes. This is the first time that we are seeing this roster together, so naturally, I just want to see how it gels. But Bridget Carlton is probably, like, the focus area for me if I had to pick one for Portland. And for Seattle, like, it's seeing how the young players build things out. Like, again, what is the usage for Don Belong going to look like? What's the usage for Flajay Johnson going to look like in game two? How is she able to deal with teams trying to attack her off the ball? Is she going to be more attentive? Those kind of things. That's probably where I start. What intrigues you about Firestorm?
Pacific Northwest rivalry renews. Are you intrigued by the Mercury, the Wings, or the Fever going forward?
Ooh-wee. I guess, like, yes, for the Mercury, that's more so from a roster standpoint. Shout out to Kiana Williams, by the way, 4 of 9 for 3 and the preseason debut for her. And so it's just, like, who is going to end up making this roster for Phoenix is kind of where I start on that front. Wings Fever, naturally, that's going to be the headline matchup. That's happening on Thursday. I want to see the attempt for the Dallas Wings, of course. I would imagine if everyone's in tow, and I think Arika Gumbawale is now in camp or arriving to camp, so I would imagine she's going to be available for this one. We'll see when those reports come out. If they do all play, then I would assume this is going to be Paige Beckers, Arika Gumbawale, AZ Fudd, Alana Smith, and Jessica Shepherd as your starting five. I want to see what AZ at three looks like defensively, or just in general. We had a similar conversation. Just how are they going to divvy up the matchups defensively? And then from there, what are the coverage going to look like? What is the help pressure behind that going to look like, et cetera? But I want to see this Wings defense just conceptually. What does that look like? Where are the temps going to be? Especially when you factor in you were playing an Indiana Fever team that, as we talked about earlier, we want to get the ball up. We will flow side to side. We're going to put a lot of pressure on you if you are not tidy. And so, like, fun early test for the Dallas Wings. So I want to see what that looks like structurally. Offensively, I'm not super concerned. Like, Paige Becker's just incredibly good at basketball. AZ brings you very obvious off-ball value. So naturally tied to that, like, what do the closeout attacks look like? How often is she initiating offense? What do those drives look like? You're going to be keeping an eye on that. But, like, I think between those two and those three, you add in Arike, the screening and the help work that Landa Smith and or Jessica Shepherd can do. Like, it's easy to picture how they're going to be able to create advantages offensively. So I'm excited to see it in earnest, of course. But my eyes kind of go to the defense in that particular matchup. What say you, good sir?
I just want to see if the Wings are able to defend at a high level. I want to see if people are incredibly wrong about what AZ Fug can contribute to the Wings as far as the defensive activity and then the on-ball creation. Doesn't have to be relied on offensively, but they can create different things. So, again, we'll see what the attempt looks like.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. All right, with that, we are going to get out of here. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where a lot of the W stuff is going for the YouTube watchers. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.